Welcome to the IFOA Sustainability Board SDGs podcast series. Launched in 2015, the UN Sustainable Development Goals are a blueprint for peace and prosperity for people and planet. The 17 goals represent a rare agreement in international policy. Adopted by all UN member states, they are cross-cutting and wide-reaching, from no poverty and quality education to affordable clean energy and climate action. They recognize that strategies to end social deprivations go hand in hand with protecting our precious environment. In this series, we welcome expertise from a range of guests, both from within and outside of the profession, reflecting the collaboration required to achieve progress. We highlight the relevance of these goals to areas of actuarial practice, explore the opportunities for actuaries to step up and contribute, and showcase those already working towards this bold agenda. Hello, I'm Sham Garriel, and I'll be hosting today's episode. I'm an investment consultant and a member of the IFOA Sustainability Board, where I specialize in work on the Sustainable Development Goals. In this session, we're speaking to Daniel Clark from the Center for Disaster Protection about the work they're doing and the role it plays in achieving the SDGs. Daniel is an actuary who spent time in private sector consulting, academia, the World Bank, and the Government Actuaries Department, and is currently the director at the Center for Disaster Protection. Daniel, thank you for joining me and welcome.
Thank you for inviting me, Sean.
No worries. So if we get straight into this, I'd like to start with an introduction to the Center for Disaster Protection. Can you give us an overview of what it is, why it was set up, and what are its values and mission?
Of course, thank you. So our mission is to stop disasters from being treated like surprises. So we want to change the way the world prepares and pays for disasters. And we do this by working with countries and the international system to identify, plan for, and finance disasters before they strike. So we provide advice, we invest in research, and we advocate for a better system.
Excellent. So I gave an introduction to you just then about some of the roles you've had. And I was just wondering if you would like to add a bit about your journey into your current role.
So I did a master's degree, then trained to be an actuary at a pensions consultancy. Then it went a bit more unusual from an actuarial perspective in that I left to go and do a master's and then PhD in development economics. Then I had a sort of complicated period where I was juggling three different jobs. I was lecturing, I was researching, and I was also starting to work for the World Bank. Then I moved to full-time work at the World Bank, and then a short-time stint as a UK civil servant before my current role leading the Centre for Disaster Protection. So that's the sort of CV. I think a different perspective on my journey is I've been very lucky in a number of ways and a number of times. So back in 2008, when I started working for the World Bank, I was quite fortunate the World Bank was starting to work on financial protection against disasters. And they had a very, very small team. And I joined right at the very beginning. By the time I left the World Bank, it was a much, much larger team. So I was really fortunate in getting in there at the beginning because it was a really interesting, exciting time. And then I also had a lot of obstacles that other people face I didn't face. So my father was actually an actuary. Back in the day, he would have been considered a wider fields actuary. He was working in investment in asset management. And so training as an actuary was something that I grew up thinking was possible. And I had a sort of supportive family and really good educational opportunities. So second broad theme is around hard work. So not many people, when they've just finished the actuarial exams, decide they want to go off and do a master's degree and then a PhD. So a lot of work and a lot of sort of trying to learn lots of different kinds of things.
So perhaps we could step through some of the ways in which the Centre for Disaster Protection helps support the SDGs. And as ever, there are interactions across multiple goals of the SDGs. So if we start with goal one, no poverty, goal three, which is good health and well-being, and goal five, gender equality, could you perhaps outline why it is important to address these issues when we think about disaster protection and the ways in which we can achieve it?
Sure. Well, I mean, start off by thinking about what disasters can do to poverty, to health, to gender equality. Obviously, we're living through the largest global shared experience of crisis since the Second World War. The COVID pandemic and the very many crises that are sort of coming from that. we already have, according to the World Bank, we already have more than 120 million people have been pushed into dollar a day poverty globally, and that will be higher by the end of the pandemic. I don't need to tell anyone about the health impacts of COVID. I certainly don't need to tell UK actuaries about the health impacts of COVID, both direct health impacts as well as the indirect health impacts from things like lost vaccinations and reduced maternal care. And then on gender equality, United Nations Women thinks that COVID could well wipe out 25 years of increasing gender equality. We see women doing a much higher share of unpaid work globally than they were, or even a higher share than they were before. And we know from everything we know about disasters and their impacts on the poorest people and poorest communities is that girls' health and education are often deprioritized. So that learning deteriorates, limited progress in closing gender gaps in education, more school dropouts, these sorts of things are all, unfortunately, this tends to happen when disasters strike. So disasters are bad for all these things. Planning ahead can help. So we believe that planning ahead needs to include financial planning. There are lots of governments around the world have preparedness plans that are never consulted when a disaster strikes, because when a disaster strikes, then people sit around the table and work out how they're going to pay for it and who's going to pay. And you have a sort of quite long-winded process of, deciding who's going to pay for what. But we think that sort of having finance ready to go as well as the capacity to respond ready to go is really important. And there is, the evidence on the impact of better planning for disasters is actually still quite weak, but there is some impact. So if you look at, in July last year, there were large floods in Bangladesh. And typically, the international system would respond quite slowly to these floods. But last year, the UN actually responded 2 days before the floods. They'd arranged finance and preparedness in advance, and they arranged 2 days before the floods to provide cash transfers to households who, based on meteorological predictions, they thought would be affected by the flood, as well as providing things like barrels to farmers for them to store their tools in so that they'd be safe from the water, and sharing sort of sanitary products with women to support hygiene throughout the flood. And that early action seems to be much more effective than the typical late action against flooding. We also have, there's a randomized control trial run by some researchers at Berkeley looking at Mexico's scheme for natural disasters, which is mostly around reconstructing public assets following disasters. And Mexico gets hit by disasters, unfortunately, quite frequently. They have, I think, 50 recorded disasters per year on average. And they have quite a sophisticated, they have had quite a sophisticated scheme of how to pay for those. And that scheme seems to have had very real impacts on healthcare, to the extent that, although the scheme was it wasn't just rebuilding healthcare facilities, it was rebuilding roads, reconstructing schools. It looks like the healthcare benefits alone from the scheme would be enough to benefit paying for the entire scheme. It would seem logical that planning better, including financial planning, to lead to faster response would lead to better outcomes when it comes to poverty health in particular. And there is some evidence that that's the case. When it comes to planning ahead and the impact on gender equality, this is complicated and the evidence there is quite mixed. So gender equality is obviously, it's sort of in the name, it is one aspect of inequality. And, we do find that there are, in the historical record, there are large disasters that have substantially affected wealthy, powerful people and destroyed their assets, which have significantly reduced various forms of inequality. So there are examples when disasters have been beneficial for gender equality, and there are examples when disasters have been harmful for gender inequality.
So no surprise, really, that preparedness builds resilience against disasters, but good to hear how it affects different areas of the individual SDGs. And much of building resilience is about protecting local communities, and that includes their ability to work, as you mentioned, and their incomes. This covers Goal 8, which is decent work, Goal 9, industry, infrastructure and innovation, and Goal 11, sustainable cities and communities. So I was just wondering if you could outline some of the things the Centre for Disaster Protection is involved in that support these areas.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think it's again, if we go back to Mexico, there's another impact evaluation by a part of the same team, which looks at the overall impact of the government being financially prepared against disasters, their scheme Fonden, their Fund for Natural Disasters, the impact of that on economic activity, on GDP. And they find that Fonden, this scheme, increases local GDP by between 2 and 4 percentage points over the 2 years in the aftermath of the disaster. And they think that the mechanism for that is by reconstructing quicker, by getting public assets online quicker, they're getting public services online quicker. So getting roads built, by getting health services. And this is helping create the environment for jobs, for economic growth, etc. We also have a lot of evidence actually on agricultural insurance for farmers. So there's a lot of evidence that farmers don't invest in agricultural technologies like, you know, fertilizer or improved seeds, in part due to a concern about risk. So if you spend all this money at the start of the season on inputs that will increase your productivity on average, but then you get hit by something which destroys your entire crop, you actually end up at the end of the season worse off than you would have been if you hadn't paid for those inputs. And this is something that makes farmers nervous. And so they don't invest in those production boosting investments as much as they should, or as much as they would like to. And making farmers feel protected against those shocks actually leads to significant increases in their investments. So better financial protection, as well as obviously providing that direct protection, can give people the confidence to invest in their businesses or in their, you know, in their incomes.
So clearly these sort of actions require a lot of work in partnerships and building people's understanding in different areas. And one of the goals that is often talked about less, but is incredibly important, is goal 17, which is partnerships for the goals. So thinking about international institutions necessary to deliver on them, could you outline the importance of this and the ways in which it currently functions?
So partnership is really critical, but it's also really important to have the right kind of partnership. So when it comes to natural hazards, we are stronger together, but the way that we partner often determines whether shocks turn into disasters with huge suffering and loss of life, or whether they're nipped in the bud and they end up being more of an annoyance. So the most natural way to partner for disasters, unfortunately, is to wait until a disaster strikes and then work out how you're going to, you know, help each other. And for discussions to really start on responding to the disaster. And this is at a sort of a household level. So disaster researchers will often say, you know, what's the best thing you can do to prepare for a disaster? It's go and talk to your neighbours. And beyond that, you know, often governments will wait until a disaster strikes to then make up public policy for disaster response. So they won't, it won't be clear to people or to businesses what government would do in the event of a disaster. Often the policy is made up as they go along. And, you know, a lot of disaster preparedness plans, as I mentioned before, a lot of disaster preparedness plans aren't even consulted when a disaster strikes. And then if you move to the international system, this is largely how the international system has been set up for disasters. So a disaster hits, it shows up on the news and on TV screens, an appeal is launched for funding, and then funding is found, either new funding, people providing, you know, announcing funding, or money is reallocated from existing aid budgets. And now this is a form of international partnership, and it's a form of international partnership that has done an enormous amount of good, but there are other kinds of partnerships where those partnerships are planned in advance, where instead of waiting until the disaster strikes to work out who will do what, those discussions happen before the disaster, and finances and response is ready in advance, ready to go. And the advantage of that kind of partnership is that it can give you faster response. It can, for tomorrow's potential disaster victims, it can provide more predictability. They know what public policy will be. They know what will be provided. It can provide more dignity. Instead of having to wait around until a disaster strikes and then hand out a begging bowl, it can be more dignified in terms of sort of knowing what may be coming your way. It can support better national conversations. So if you plan in advance and you're committed to planning in advance, you can have better, more robust conversations about what those decisions are and what those trade-offs are than you're able to have in the throes of a disaster. And it allows you to bring in different kinds of expertise, from logistic expertise to financial planning expertise, ahead of time to try to make sure that what you're doing is as cost effective as it possibly could be.
Well, there's plenty of different disasters forecast due to climate change. So if we turn our attention to climate action as something that has received a lot of international attention in the last couple of years, what are the lessons we can learn from dealing with a climate crisis and delivering action on disaster protection?
Well, I think it does show us that our world and our politics make it, you know, really hard to manage disaster risks well. You know, there's a lot of short-termism, and there's a lot of sort of acting surprise when disasters strike or when the climate changes. And, you know, as I mentioned before, disaster policy is often made up as we go along. And this leads to, you know, bad, inefficient decisions, not only about response, but also about, you know, preventing and, you know, reducing, mitigating the potential impacts of disasters. And we clearly can't do that for climate change. We clearly shouldn't do that for climate change. An analogy I really like about this is central banking. So back in the 70s, the conventional wisdom at the time was that the role of a central bank was to set short-term interest rates. And through the experience of the 70s and, you know, a lot of academic papers and, you know, which eventually led to the wave of central bank independence in the 90s, it was acknowledged that actually the role of central banks is not just to set short-term interest rates, but also to set expectations about future interest rates. And by doing this, you could substantially improve economic efficiency and economic outcomes. And I think we need the same realization as societies and as a global community that the role of public policy for disasters cannot be just deciding, you know, what disaster policy should be as you go along in the throes of a disaster. A lot of it is around setting predictable public policy. So I think we really do need that shift. Secondly, I think as everybody who didn't realize beforehand now realizes, disasters are political. They are a political struggle, not just a technical exercise. You know, there is a struggle over who is protected, what they're protected against, how the protection is delivered, and who pays for that protection. And that is a struggle. And we need to find ways to have better struggles, to come up with better solutions to disasters ahead of time. Because too often that struggle happens once a disaster is hit. And what we need to learn to do is to have that struggle before disaster hits. And then thirdly, we need to draw some different insights from good risk management. So I would say that if you look at disaster insurance, I think one of the secret sources of disaster insurance is actually good, appropriate insurance regulation, which helps reduce the asymmetry of information between the provider of insurance and the purchaser of insurance. And it helps to ensure that people know what it is that they're buying and that what they're buying will deliver fair outcomes. And we don't have that for our political systems. We don't have a regulator that tries to ensure the extent to which people are protected or people are not protected against disasters. And I think it's a bit odd that we have societies where insurance policies are safer than our societies are. So I think we need to, you know, get much more comfortable with the idea of independent challenge and scrutiny of how safe we really are from disasters. And we need to listen to that and use that as a way to help us to shape better societies.
So another very relevant international crisis is that of the current COVID-19 pandemic, which you mentioned earlier. So the Center for Disaster Protection are leading the Crisis Lookout Coalition, which aims to better predict, prepare, and protect people from crises. Can you give us an overview of this work?
Yes, I'd be delighted to. So first, who is the Crisis Lookout Coalition? So we're a collection of more than 45 and increasing by the day local to global organisations who are committed to changing how the international system pays for crises. And we include 5 United Nations agencies, 2 networks of locally led civil society organisations, leading international NGOs like the International Rescue Committee, Save the Children, the Red Cross, Red Crescent Movement, and academics such as University of Oxford's Professor Sir Paul Collier. It includes the Insurance Development Forum, which is a collection of insurance industry organisations as well as public sector organisations and governments as well. So we are sort of joined together to make 3 asks for the G7. And you stated those 3 asks, so it's around, you know, predicting, preparing and protecting. So predicting crises better. So too many crisis risks are invisible from the balance sheets of the international system. So if you think about an earthquake in Haiti, for example, the international system will not recognise that as a risk until the disaster happens. And it treats these crises as though they're sort of invisible on the balance sheet until they suddenly materialise. And we need to improve the quality of conversations and the quality of challenge about tomorrow's crises. We need to start being able to say, look, that, you know, this is the likelihood of an earthquake in Haiti next year. This is the likelihood of a drought in Somalia. This is the likelihood of a flood in Pakistan. How prepared is the international system to do what it will do in the event of that? Because many of these disasters, we know that the international system will provide some response. So helping to provide that challenge function and really opening the eyes of the system to tomorrow, because at the moment, the international system is based on banks and bank accounts. that don't look to tomorrow's crisis risks in a systematic way and don't make efficient decisions around preparing for them. So firstly, it's around predicting and better understanding of risks and challenging on risks. The second ask for the G7 is around preparing better. And specifically, we want to make pre-arranged finance the default by 2030. So if it can be arranged in advance, it should be. Now, many of you will listening to this podcast will know about the net zero by 2050 policy for climate mitigation, which acts as a sort of lodestar policy. It's a political commitment where, you know, we need to find the solution to how to get there. It doesn't include all the details of how we're going to get there, but it helps to facilitate and create space for the right conversations to happen about how to get there, to get to net zero by 2050. And we believe that making pre-arranged finance the default for the international system by 2030 will act like a lodestar policy, like that net zero by 2050. We don't know exactly how we'll get there, but we think that is the right political commitment to make towards a better system. Now, it may seem obvious that, you know, we should be planning financially for tomorrow's disasters. But as I've mentioned, you know, this would require quite a systemic shift in the international system. Now, some risks really are unknowable, but many of the risks and shocks that the international system responds to really are knowable. So if we look at, we recently conducted a set of research on 9 recent disasters, where we found that only 2% of the funding that eventually came through the international system, only 2% of that funding had been arranged in advance. And this led to slow response. In Kenya in 2015, 2016, within 2 months of emergency drought being declared, only 11% of the funding that was eventually to come, only 11% of it had actually arrived within 2 months. That was even worse in Lesotho in 2019, where it was only 1%. There's a facility at the World Bank, the Crisis Response Window, which was $3 billion, which over the decade leading up to COVID took 398 days from the first date of the crisis to the first dollar flowing from that facility. Now, the World Bank's been doing a lot of work to improve it, but that's the sort of baseline that we're sort of working from in terms of speed of response. And if you compare that to things like insurance, insurance can pay in days or weeks, and it can be predictable. I mean, I've talked about Mexico's Fonden scheme. So I think, you know, we need to be rethinking that pre-arranged finance can lead to a number of benefits. And I think we should be making it the default. And there will be disagreements on what the optimum way of doing it, you know, whether governments or international organizations should basically act like insurers or whether they themselves should buy reinsurance. But these are the right conversations to be had if we want to be making sure that, you know, crises don't lead to great devastation and suffering. And then our final ask is to do all this in a way that leaves no one behind. So, you know, too often people are left behind by disasters and crises. And, you know, there's this difficult trade-off between when it comes to aid in, you know, do you support the country that is most able to use the aid money, which tend to be countries with, you know, better governance, better government delivery, or do you send that money in places where it's much harder to work, but, you know, people are much more in need? And I think our third ask is really around that, you know, making sure that no one is left behind. You know, every single country has noticed when it comes to COVID that it does disproportionately affect those who are poorest or are marginalized or most vulnerable in society. It sort of it acts as a spotlight on existing inequalities. And the international system needs to acknowledge that and ensure that it is acting in a way that does leave no one behind.
Well, sounds like you're very busy there. Got your work cut out for you, maybe. And the Center for Disaster Protection is doing a lot, and there are many players involved, which will obviously take time and cost a bit of money. So I just wanted to turn to the funding aspect of this Center for Disaster Protection. And this is currently funded by
the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office.
And so will the recent changes to foreign aid impact the work that the Center for Disaster Protection can do? And might this end up being a false economy, because there have been budget cuts, basically, might this end up being a false economy if it leads to less preparedness or hinders progress against climate change action? For example, families in vulnerable regions keeping some money aside rather than, say, spending on clean cooking facilities or getting children to work to increase their income rather than educating them?
It's a great question with lots of parts. So I'm really pleased that FCDO, the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office, has committed to ensure that our work, the work of the Centre for Disaster Protection, is going to be possible? Well, regardless of the size of the pie, we believe that aid does save lives, it can save lives, but it can also do more. So a lot of what I've been talking about today is around doing more with resources. It's not necessarily around, you know, needing more money. There's a question about, you know, how much money is needed, but there's also a question of, you know, how can you squeeze the most value out of money as possible to ensure that crises are paid for with money, not with lives. So I think we do need a much more modern system, international system, that's based on predicting, it's based on planning for future disasters, it's based on, you know, understanding risks and looking ahead. But we don't have that yet, and we need that. And that's regardless of how much money is going through the system, you know, we need a better system, and that's what we're calling the G7 for.
So another question which sort of relates to how actuaries can get involved in this type of work. Do you reckon you could expand on how you feel actuaries could apply their skill set to disaster risk management?
Sure. So it may come as no surprise to you, but I very strongly believe that actuaries have a lot that they can bring to better disaster risk management. I do think that when it comes to, you know, disaster risk management across the world, one of the key attributes of actuaries is humility and a deep willingness to learn and to learn from others and other people's taught as well as lived experience. These are areas where actuaries have a role to play as part of a conversation with other experts and with people with lived experience. And then the second point I wanted to make is, so actuaries do tend to work on, you know, they tend to get paid for working on those risks that somebody wants to pay to get them managed. But I strongly believe that the biggest social benefits are from work for those risks where nobody's currently involved in managing them. If you take pandemic risks before COVID, for example, now there, the question is not around how can you design a better technical solution to manage those risks. It's about the struggle over who is protected, what are they protected against, who's going to pay, who will deliver. And you know, the actual exams don't teach that. You need to be quite savvy with being able to influence the media, for example, whereas actuaries are typically trained to communicate with clients, not with the press. But actuaries are continuing to find their roles. And the UK Professions COVID-19 Response Group is a great example of what actuaries can do if they have a good understanding of the context around them, if they want to work on a risk that is not being managed anywhere in the world, you know, as it should be, and want to help. So I think it's a real demonstration of what actuaries can do. And what I would really like to see is, you know, similar initiatives, but, you know, not having to wait until the crisis is in full flow before it happens, but really helping with that financial planning before the crisis. But for crises where actuaries currently aren't already employed to work on them.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really interesting to understand the issues and opportunities in a space where perhaps an actuarial skill set could be employed, together with learning in some other very interesting areas. So just to sort of wrap up, would you like to let the listeners know where they can find out more information about the work taking place to help stop disasters impacting lives in these ways, and where they can find you perhaps online and your organization?
Certainly. Well, I mean, the Centre for Disaster Protection, find us online at disasterprotection.org. And we're also very active on Twitter. The Crisis Lookout Coalition has its own Twitter handle. So, you know, feel free to have a look there. And, you know, there's lots of research publications. There's lots of information about the campaign there. I think for those interested in potentially spending some time actually working on this topic, we're also going to be looking to recruit over the next year or so. We have a very small team at the moment. We're looking to scale up our team. So please do sign up to our mailing list if you're interested in finding out about future opportunities to work with us as well.
Well, thank you again, Daniel. It's been really positive listening to the work that you're doing to help prepare often really vulnerable people from disasters, which we know climate change will bring more of, and particularly important as many of these people contributed least to the changing climate, but can also help combat it if they're given the opportunities.
Great. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.